Welcome back to Real Talk with REB, where we tackle real problems with real people and discover real solutions. I'm your host, Munasha Dzikiti, the Communications and Community Management Officer at REB Incubator. And for those who don't know us, REB is a nonprofit impact entrepreneurship incubator dedicated to driving social change in South Africa. Today, we're proud to have Nomonde Buthelezi and Sanelisiwe Nyaba, who have joined us in discussing the topic of urban food spaces and its growing importance in modern South Africa. Sanelisiwe Nyaba is a multimodal artist, writer, co-researcher and food activist. She is currently serving as a board member at Food Agency Cape Town, a co-research-led organization doing food research in communities in Cape Town. She is also pursuing her master's at the University of Cape Town, where she is exploring the intersection of food and motherhood using qualitative art methodology. The overall theme of Sanelisiwe's work is using storytelling as a method into a deeper analysis of empirical data in food security research, while also exploring ways of using art to simply tell stories about herself, her community, and everyday lived experiences. While Nomonde Buthelezi, who is the co-founder and project coordinator for Food Agency Cape Town, passionately known as FACT, a community-led food systems research organization that advocates for the people's right to food through community activism and community dialogues. She has co-published a number of opinion papers and research articles. Thank you, ladies, for joining us. We are incredibly thrilled to have you here with us. You've done so much amazing work. Before we dive into this topic, I would love to give you the platform to introduce yourselves. Tell us a bit more about the work you do at Food Agency Cape Town and your roles in the organization. So I'll start with you, Sanelisiwe.
Thank you, Munashe. Thank you for the invite. As you've already, I think, laid the foundation, my government name is Sanelisiwe Nyaba, but I do go by Mimi, affectionately. Right. I do work with Food Agency Cape Town. The background of my work with Food Agency Cape Town has especially been the concern around the inaccessibility of the language in food security, or the language of research, especially in communities,
right,
where the research is especially being done. So my key concerns when I came into the food security space and when I started working with co-research was, how are we going to bring this work back into the communities? Because one of the fundamental sort of frameworks or ethics rather of co-research is that when the research has been done within the community,
right,
you need to come back and share back the results with the community and explore what kind of the outcomes and explore the recommendation that the communities wants to take.
Right.
And my question when we going back from 2020, I think Mrs. Nomonde will really cover the initial background of the study that I'm referring to now.
Right.
But when we had finished the study and we had this beautiful yellow textbook, my question was, how are we going to take this work back into the community with a textbook? So I started then exploring ways through the arts. Initially, it was a film, where we broke down the research into storytelling, and it was also this way that allowed us to look at the stories behind the numbers. And so that research was a household data, and the idea was to go inside the household and not just look at so many, and so many households do not have enough food, but rather what are the dynamics that take place on the everyday experience of people who do not have access to food.
Okay.
And this has been a driving concern of mine within the work and within Food Agency Cape Town, and which has led now to my master's thesis, which is also part of the program that we are currently working with, the Urban Food Futures, where then I'm trying to kind of further this potential of arts methods and the potential that it has in not only giving agency to the people who are taking part in the research, but also it allows a kind of power in having your own voice within a research, and the analysis is being led by the participants themselves.
Right.
And so I think I'm trying to capture the sort of art methods that we have come out with in Food Agency Cape Town,
right.
That I have led and co-curated with other artists, such as poetry, that was responding back to a study.
Right.
And the last offering has been a theater of the oppressed process,
right.
Which in and of itself then was a key part in really going from, we want to involve artists from the beginning of a process. So we work with artists that had already in some way or the other worked with us in the food security research, and we conceptualized and put together a theater of the oppressed as a response in thinking about the future of food, thinking about the current sort of food injustice within our city especially.
Right.
Yeah, and now my key concern with Food Agency Cape Town is also looking at what kind of sort of partnerships we're forming in the future going forward, with locally and globally as well. I will hand it over to my colleagues.
Amazing. Firstly, before you go on, the thought of bringing together arts and the food space or the food environment, this is completely foreign to me. I think it's beautiful that you're able to make that connection and share the stories of people that are going through those experiences. So thank you.
Thank you.
Please feel free to go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you, Munashe. And again, thank you for having us. We really appreciate the opportunity. But I must say, even for us, it was a real learning curve having to put together research and art. But like Umimi had said before, it really comes, when we do research, we need to share back the results, but we work with communities, people that do not understand the academic language,
right.
That the research papers or outputs are written in.
Yeah.
So how do we share? The real question was, how do we share? How do we let you know? How do we give back to you what the research was about and at the same time get your feedback or input?
Yes.
So that's really how we are exploring quite various ways on how we do that. So you've given a brief background on who our organization is, and Mimi has sort of given a little bit of, or a lot actually, of what we do. But with that comes, so I was involved with the research at the end of 2018,
right.
A study that has been happening since 2016. So I came in quite at the tail of the research,
right.
But we were with it up until today. So that was before FACT at the time. So I'm also an urban food grower. So the research was looking at growing food in South Africa and Mozambique in the urban spaces, yes. So we did that research, and so there was quite a lot of findings and obviously a lot of recommendations that came with that research.
Right.
And then at the end of that, so just some of the challenges that we have faced as farmers was the environment that we grow the food in the cities. It's very poor, sandy soil, so we don't really quite produce quality. And also that affected our access to market.
Right.
So that was one of the biggest challenges. We always would be, how do we access market? We need access to markets. And also some of the biggest findings was that we really run the farms out of our own pockets. The profit is really not that much. So where are the gaps? The gaps in us having to use a lot of our own income,
right.
That goes into the farms, but really getting back almost nothing. The second one was the health aspect of it. We grow organic food, but we don't grow for our own communities. We ourselves do not consume the very same food that we eat, yet it's organic and healthy food. So the money that we get from that, we go to our local big markets and we buy the commercially produced. Yeah. So those conflicts, you know, and just those gaps, because we grow food, but we grow for other people, you know, where we're excited when a paki comes and packages your food and then it's sold, you know, to people who are very health conscious, who knows that they want organic food, who live on the other side of town. So it was, the research was really exploring and looking at those things. How do we bridge those gaps now that we've identified them?
Hmm.
But COVID happened, and the research also finished.
Okay.
So COVID has affected us, most of us farmers, hugely. I'm one person who had lost my farm, so I haven't been able to recover and start growing again since COVID happened. But with that, the beauty of it was we've managed to have partnership with a research organization, which was based in Berlin, the Urban Food Futures Program, or Mimi has referred to. So it's TMG, Think Tank for Sustainability.
Right.
So FACT was really a response, or it came as a response from communities, because we did COVID happened and we suddenly locked down, you know, we don't know what to do, what to put together with what, in fact, what is happening around the world, because you are so locked in in your own space. And, you know, from community people, we're not used to that. We're very outdoors people.
Yeah.
We are not, we don't, you know, we don't like to be locked in.
Right, yes.
We are people's people, you know, we want to be, you know, with our peers. But with all of that happening, with a lady, a young girl that was doing her research in the urban food farming in South Africa and Mozambique, she was on the other end of the line, always checking, how are you guys? How are you guys coping?
Mm-hmm.
So we did a very small research then, just to look at how are we as farmers coping or not coping during the times of COVID. So we shared back those results. We had a few triangulation workshops.
Right.
And then the question then became great on how are my neighbors coping?
Mm.
How's the rest of the community coping? So there was a lot of frustration during that time, how we thought food wasn't going to the people that they were supposed to, and also the question of food, what food are we talking about?
Mm.
So we were looking at the food parcels. My child was at school, still is at school, so they would bring a food parcel at home, and I would be like, where's the food?
Oh, wow.
You know, where's the food in this? So I am a farmer, I grow food, my food is going off on the beds because I'm locked down,
right?
And yet there are no vegetables in this food parcels, so it is a food parcel. So where's the health aspect of it? So just looking at the food parcels that were being circulated, where the question was, is this food, you know? So whoever decided on to make up this particular food parcel, then the question was, actually, who gets to decide? Why wasn't anybody, why didn't anybody bother to ask me what, you know, what are your challenges are and how can I help you?
Right.
So that frustration came with us gate crashing certain meetings or in the online space. So that was also how most of us got introduced to the Zoom platform, to the meetings, you know, the Teams meetings, because I was doing a short course on finance literacy in micromanagement. So I had a lot of data. I had this Zoom that I was curious about. I needed to know how to navigate through the, you know, the reactions, how do you raise hands, and somebody is sending me a link. I go into this platform. Luckily, on the day is when some city officials were there with some organizations where they were saying, this is the amount of money that's out there to help people in communities with food parcels. So we had this lady on the other end where we were venting, and then so all these questions was like, you know, there was this wonder, how is everybody else feeling about this in the communities? That then gave birth to FACT, because people were like, the one thing that we've realized during that study is that we actually don't have any agency when it comes to food, or we don't even understand whether we do have a right to food. If so, what is it? What does it look like? When it comes to policies, we don't have an input, we're not being considered. So how does that work? Just navigating through all that academic space was really a challenge for us. So that's then the beauty of the partnerships that we've had with the academic research organizations, which is Food Agency Cape Town. I'm going to park it at that.
Right.
So in case you have any follow-up questions, then we can continue.
Yes. No, thank you so much for that breakdown. That puts a lot to perspective for me. I you know, you during COVID particularly, you heard a lot about people are struggling, but we didn't understand, or I personally didn't understand to what extent. But I want to take a couple of steps back. So for me personally, I come from a marketing and a legal background. So when it comes to the conversation of food systems or food, very basic knowledge, and for the most part, it's consumer like centered knowledge of you just go to the shop and you buy. I would like for us to break down what are urban farming methods, what qualifies as an urban farming method. I'll give that off to you.
I saw that coming to me. So there are different urban farming methods, and I'm going to speak from a smallholder farmer's perspective, because I cannot speak on commercial farming. I don't have enough knowledge to really speak, except for what I see and what everybody else sees. So for me as a small-scale farmer, when I started growing, it was really for my own consumption. I really had a few health scares. At the time, I was a borderline diabetic. I've just been told I've got irritable bowel syndrome. I didn't know any of those things, what they were. So it sent me on a research journey, you know, and then this term, consume organic foods, and I went into shops. You just said now it's the your study is about consumer oriented market, like it's just people who go in and buy and consume. But for me, it's actually more than that. So from somebody that comes from the township, the food that I was supposedly to be eating were not available where I lived. It had me sending me to the CBD to look for those food, and I looked at the prices, and still I was like, okay, I'm not gonna die today, so I'm not buying this. So it goes back to our work that we do in the communities, that we also get dictated to what kinds of foods we have access to by how much I have in my pocket, so that also dictates on what's available on the shelves, regardless of the health aspect that comes with it. So and then luckily I was introduced to organic farming, so I started growing at a very, very small scale. That also comes with its own challenges. You don't really, I would love to see my produce or any produce from the townships in these big shops, and I would love to see it also in my local shops, where, and I would love my neighbors and the people in my immediate community consume. So for me, that means from production perspective, the food when it's produced, when it's sold, and to where it's being prepared and consumed. So like your local markets, we have fruit and vegetable stalls all over. For me, that's what comes to mind. And like eateries, you know, we have gassy eateries where we buy, if you can buy your fed cook with a slab of tomato and a slab of lettuce, but where is it sourced? You know, where was that lettuce bought from? You know, we have people on the street, almost in every street corner, where you have your fruit and veg vendors, but where do they source those?
And they're very affordable, too.
So for me, that's like an urban food space for me. Like, so where I live, I believe that the foods that are, that I would say maybe culturally fitting for me should be available in the next corner where I live. Because we live in cities where we have a lot of diverse people that live with. So you need to feel at home. You have certain foods that would remind you of home. So regardless of where you, most of the people that are in the urban cities are from different parts of the world. But you're here to work or to study, or but you would love a certain, you know, a particular food that that reminds you of home, you know, like salsa, you know, you want those foods. So but then with that also, you'd find a big supermarket with a lot of shops, like a shopping, small shopping complex. And those food may not, you find people outside on the very, like on the stoop or outside the gate that are selling those foods. So with our work, one of the other things that we've come to realize with the research is that those people, they have their own challenges with the, you know, with the bylaws and the city of Cape Town, where people are here trying to make a living and probably trying to provide culturally, I would say, appropriate food to the very same people that they live with in the communities, but they don't have the necessary or the correct papers. So they, you know, they stand a chance of being evicted, removed. And then so that comes with a lot of red tapes or hoops that they need to go through in order to have, you know, proper papers. And where we buy our smileys and our chicken feet, and those city views those places as just unhygienic, you know, and as care. Oh, yes, they are. But again, why is it like that? So where are the gaps? How do we make it better? Because those are the markets that we want to frequent.
Yes.
But because they don't have the proper paper. So it goes back to
retail,
the whole system.
Yes. Yeah. You mentioned so many very, very valid and real points. Firstly, I want to touch on the topic of organic food being accessible or affordable to the average person or someone who's earning a low income. There, from what I'm hearing, there's a lot of talk about, oh, it's a misconception that organic food is unaffordable or it's not affordable. How true is that? Is it affordable? Is it not affordable? Can the average person that is earning a basic South African salary sustain themselves on the salary with organic food? Is it as accessible as people make it out to be?
Some of the motivation that I've had in actually wanting to start my own organic growing farm was to debunk that organic food shouldn't be, advertised as being expensive. It's very much accessible and it's very much affordable. The challenge, however, that we face is even in our activism space, we have, in as much as we're trying to advocate for agency, we have a challenge of urgency. So some of these organic foods are really slow growing.
Right.
And like I said, the challenges that we've had is they're really making your soils healthy to produce to the, a very, a big head of cabbage. Mm-hmm. So my cabbage is growing slowly because I've got poor sandy soils. I've got challenges getting out inputs into my farm and pest, pest management. So those are just some of the contributions that makes my food to grow slowly and not be as big as feeding a family of eight.
Right.
So it's not like it's not accessible or it's so expensive. It's just that maybe it's not big enough and it's not growing as fast as, as it's supposed
to. Okay, that makes sense. And I'd love to hear from both of you. You mentioned how, we need to get more people who are building from township communities or growing food from township communities. We need to give them a platform where they can sell in bigger retail markets. How do we go about, initiating that? What are the current constraints keeping that from happening?
One, we are disorganized. We operate in silos. In Cape Town, we compete for market access. We compete for, for market access. We have challenges getting assistance from those that can assist. And with those challenges we do get a lot of assistance, let me say, from outside funding, from external donors, but they want security. Right. Nobody's going to come from another country and just give you maybe a voucher for 50,000 rand when you're not secured, when tomorrow you could be evicted from where you're. So security also, tenure security becomes a problem. Right. We farm from schools, from city-owned buildings where tomorrow the school's governing body can decide they want extra classrooms. So please, then your land is the next available space. So those are just some of the challenges that we face.
Right.
Amongst many.
Wow. And Mimi, are they suddenly see where
Mimi, we go by Mimi.
Right, okay, Mimi, yes. Awesome. Are there any challenges that you have seen that maybe Nomonde hasn't pointed out?
I'm always going to the politics of land in Cape Town. I'm not a farmer myself, but my mother is a farmer, and as I've experienced and Mama Hazel Nyaba, they will always, when they introduce themselves, they will always say, I am a landless farmer. And I think this is a very political statement, but two, it also speaks to the kind of environment that they're growing in within even the context of Cape Town. So I think we've got a land problem. Another is a policy problem that is very much connected to the land.
Right.
So I think those are, the prominent issues that I have seen kind of get in the way of seeing the success of a growing market in Cape Town and in urban spaces especially.
Wow, thank you for pointing that out. And I'm wondering, when it comes to urban food spaces, is there any chance, I mean, you have mentioned as well as yourself, Nomonde, that there are limited resources when it comes to what people, particularly in township areas, can do with their food spaces. Is there any chance that these spaces, however, despite these limitations, have served as a platform for youth empowerment, whether it's education, especially when it comes to food security and sustainability?
So a lot of, I'm going to start back and then kind of try to answer
your
question.
Go for it, yeah.
So a lot of, there's a lot of debate amongst food security experts. I'm not a food security expert because I critique a lot of this idea of experts, but yeah, a lot of food security experts will argue around this idea of whether or not urban agriculture at all has a role in aiding food security in South Africa, in Cape Town, in the world. And I think especially then if we bring it to the context of Cape Town with the problem of land, and not only the problem of land, but then the soil itself, you know, that argument does come to fruition where Sister Monday has mentioned that sometimes even the produce is, one is not growing as fast. People have an urgency and need to eat now and can't wait for the cabbage to grow, etc. So one can very much argue that from a research perspective, I think the experts can be right, but I think there's something that we tend to forget when we start to look at farming from just that perspective. I think this is where I think I critique expertise, because my mother is a farmer, and she will tell you that she learned a lot of the things that she learned from her grandparents and her great-grandparents. So I think the question then is, does this entirely dismiss the need for these practices to exist for people because they don't provide a sort of tangible solution in the greater scheme of things and food security? And I think I've gotten to a point where I really look at, when you look at how a plant grows, going from, you know, planting the seed to the seed growing into a seedling and into an actual plant. There's a process there that happens. I think that in the fabric of communities, and in that breakdown of a social fabric in poor communities especially, because things need to be fast, the urgency of making money, you need a job, you need a thing, and these are things that people don't have access to. So the things that are happening in the hood itself go against all of these processes, and people don't know actually what a seed looks like from seed to the actual food. When you ask children, you know, like, where does a banana or fruit come from? You know, so these very natural and sort of traditional ways of doing things and ways of living are entirely lost to us. And when you sort of try to introduce these things to people in community, in the very sort of historical present, I say historical present because we do have the sort of colonial, patriarchal, capitalistic sort of history, and this argument is very much vested in that.
Right.
In the historical present of communities, they will tell you you are crazy when you come and say you must plant what. But there's a kind of, when someone takes the time and really slows down to learn these processes, not just for the sake of thinking about, you know, the expertise of bringing a solution to this, to food security, that there's benefit to slowing down and looking at these processes. And I think we have a right to those processes. So yes, I have seen like the kind of impact that learning how to grow food has on people. And it might not be impact that results in large numbers or large scale, because that's how we think, right?
Yeah.
Because of how all this, we think large scale, we think, you know, but I think when we start to define impact, you know, it's not, sometimes it's not money. My mother has taught so many people how to grow food, but she's not rich. You know, she doesn't have awards, you know, and accolades. And you know, when you know you teach someone and they leave, and you don't necessarily have the evidence to say that this happened, but the impact is there. I think we just know, we need to know how to measure it and how to look at it. And I think in many ways we also need to kind of reconfigure some of the roles. That these that the potential of learning how to farm has beyond maybe very much the capitalistic idea of it.
It sounds like we have lost our indigenous touch due to capitalism, and one of the most impactful things that I've heard from a lot of our guests is that, particularly when it comes to investors for small scale farmers, you know, maybe don't always consider, you know, the going big and massive impact. Sometimes there are people who are in their small communities who are still making a massive impact, and the return on investment might not be great, but you are changing lives still. So I think that's very powerful what you said. And Nomonde, would you like to add on to that?
You know, Mimi was referring to children, like they don't know what a carrot was before it landed on the plate. I'm one who's very passionate about children and women development. And I just want to, you know, me and Mimi's mom, Mahazel, we were coming from a farm visit in Khayelitsha, and we were in a taxi, and we each had strawberry plants. And the taxi was like just teasing us, come in, you know, don't let your plants fall. What plants are those, by the way? And we're like, no, these are strawberries. Almost everybody within view turned to look, because so many people had never seen a strawberry plant. So many people, I mean, these are grown-ups I'm talking about. And now we are talking about the youth and the children. So even with our journey of educating people on how to grow food organically in their own spaces, people, you know, people are amazed that, oh, is this what it looks like? Is this the way it started before it became this? Even pineapples, a lot of people think pineapples grow from trees, you know. So there's nothing
they don't.
Exactly. So even it's very important that we start this from a very young age. So my child is not, I'm sure like any other people's children, not keen on consuming vegetables. They don't like vegetables. So you really have to be creative on introducing them. But when I started growing, and then we harvested together, so they would harvest a carrot and eat it directly. Mimi's boys, for instance, they harvest, Mahazel is, you know, very fighting. Hardly see a strawberry, you'd see a flash of red and tomorrow it's gone. So that also brings its own advantage, because in as much as it's not registering for them now, but later when they look back, they would, I always remember there was a garden I always used to harvest strawberries. So that might in the near future encourage them to also, because they had access.
Yeah.
They didn't really need money to go buy a packet of chips. It was right there on the stoop. You leave it just next door. There's, you know, something growing that you can just pick, and it's organic, and it's, you know, it's healthy. They can just eat it like that. So it's a two prong if you're looking at it. And also then you find people like Utatu Vuyani that Mimi has mentioned. His garden is at a school. So with that comes, there's a lot of gatekeeping, you know, that comes with, because we have, unfortunately, it's mostly where it's you find an available and a secure space to do a garden. But there's a lot of gatekeeping where I've been denied access, even my Hazel, to a lot of schools where we see there's land that's not being used, and we don't really understand why they would give you access, because in as much as you're saying, at the moment I don't need anything from the school, we have our own resources, we have our own networks. With Utatu Vuyani, he has a garden at the school, he's struggling to get kids into the garden. The curriculum of the children is so much that if they have time to go into the garden, it has to be an extramural activity. So most of the kids are transported, you know, so by the time they're in those, the transports are there. So it's really a struggle on getting the kids out of the classroom and into the garden. So there's really another thing that we really need to look at. Our program that we work in, the research, is urban food futures. But the very future is not part of this conversation. Because if you're looking at the future, we're talking about the children. You know, and as human, we are very social creatures. So we socialize with food. We socialize around food. Everything that we do is around food. So, you know, everybody is a consumer or a seller, but we all have a relationship to food, however it may come.
Absolutely. And I like what you said about, like, you know, you take your kids into the garden and, you know, you get them to connect with the process of growing something and eating something. I can recall to when I was back in Zimbabwe and at 4 a.m., this is now back in the rurals, my grandmother would wake us up to go and, you know, plow the field. Hated it. But now, you know, in my own apartment, I live in the city, but every time there's a little seed, garlic, or, you know, I get a pot plant and I just, you know, plant it for myself. So there's definitely a seed that is put in there when, you know, you get your kids to engage with that process. And Nomonde, you mentioned how you are passionate about women. I want to touch on how, you know, especially in underserved communities, women are particularly the ones that are responsible for bringing nutrition into the household. And I want to understand from what you guys have observed, how are women engaging with urban food systems and what impact do these spaces have in their roles and responsibilities?
I want to bring a twist to
okay.
to what, because if you're thinking about urban food spaces, we're thinking about eateries, right? We're thinking about markets, we're thinking about places where you have to spend money in order to access you know, this particular food. That also limits, you know, there are so many people that can't. Like I said, we are social creatures, so we go to these social places and we go to these eateries so that we can socialize. And sometimes the conversation can start. But for us as women, you know, if there's a function, a lot of gossip, if you want it, it's in the kitchen. You know, if you want to know who's doing what, you have to be in the kitchen to get all the juicy details about who's who in the So that's how we as women connect with food while we're there peeling the vegetables. But for us, as an organization, to ensure or to try and make sure that we actually bring, we give access to people that can't afford the food. We give them access to, we try to give them access to the healthy and the nutritious food. We work with community kitchens.
Nice.
So for me, that would be my definition of an urban food space. You don't, there's no money. So the only currency is the social currency. Sometimes people would come and they offer to volunteer, one would offer to meet. And we're currently having dialogues. Like I said to you today, I haven't had a chance to actually stay in store. So thank you for those moments that I'm having sitting because I get to take a breath. But we have food dialogues that are happening, and we are having them in the kitchens, the community kitchens, with the people, I don't like to use the word beneficiaries, but with the people that are actually coming into the kitchen to dish. So we found that most of them are led by women. These women, they are the champions, you know, they are providing for the community. So it comes back to, for me as a woman and as a household head, it is up to me to source what gets onto the table. And a lot of times, whether it's nutritionists, I would want it to be, but it's at the back of my head because I must make sure it's enough, it's quick, and it's feeding everybody.
Yes.
So the same with the kitchens. They take, it's very much taxing to the women. We had a question where we had asked them, what keeps you up at night? The one would say, I don't know what to cook tomorrow. How I will feed the people tomorrow. They share their spaces with their families. You know, their children have given up with them. They share, you know, their children share these women with their communities. So for me, that's my definition of, I would say, maybe an urban food space, and what role they play in the community, and what role the women play, because they are the hustlers. They are the ones that make sure you know, there's something to cook tomorrow. Some kitchens would love to serve 7 days a week, but they serve 2 or 3 days a week. So they're the ones that actually have to, you know, to hustle around together to make sure there's something in the pot.
Wow. Sure. I'm just taking all of that in. Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility, a lot to put on particularly one person's shoulders, you know. You essentially responsible for making sure that the people in your household are alive, breathing and healthy, you know. That's a lot. And I'd like to hear if you have anything that you want to add to this.
Yeah, I think especially thinking about community kitchens, and I'm going to bring it back, you know, to this again, the right to food, and the people who are responsible for making sure that there are provisions to people having access to that, to that right to food, and the role that women are playing in fulfilling this right.
Right.
Yeah, they are essentially doing the job that the government should be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and in many ways, our work in working with community kitchens, and especially like forming this kind of network with different community kitchens in Cape Town, is to sort of position these different models and to say, look at what the work and the impact that these kitchens are doing and are having in communities. Support them, you know. Support them in ways that are very intentional, whether it's money, whether it's resources, because we have done the research, we have recommendations that are ready, and we're working to put together a report that will say if we want to say upscale, or if we want to say have a new kitchen, how would it, you know, how would it be implemented? But again, support these women. I think that's what I want to say, you know, that there are people who are doing the work, who are responding to the crisis of food security, and they are women, and I think we need to empower and support them. I think it's one thing to clap for them and be amazed and call them heroes, but it's a whole other thing when we support them, because at this point in time, they are drawing from nothing. Imagine if they had something. You know?
And how do we go about supporting them?
I think the campaign comes in really nicely.
I think there's no one in.
I love that.
So we are working on a campaign as an organization. We are trying to shine the light to these women. You know, we're trying to make the invisible visible. Mimi had said before that they're doing what the government is supposed to be doing. So we're hoping that our campaign that we are working on is going to shine the spots, the spotlight to these women and rally for support. And this is not just people throwing in money, but you need, we're trying to really throw in the money, but we're also trying to reach for people's hearts, you know, because they are volunteers, and nobody pays them to do the work that they're doing, but yet they're still motivated to get up every morning. So any opportunity, any support that is there, even whether it's with the foodstuffs that goes towards the port, or anybody that says, I can pay a stipend towards your volunteers, but mostly tangible partnerships and collaborations with these kitchens. And we have, you know, also trying to, more than the campaign, we're trying to organize a walk. On the 16th of October is World Food Day.
Yes.
We would love some support. We're going to be, it's themed pots and pens, pens, P-E-N-S. So we will be carrying those empty pots and pens. So pens speaks to the research, the academic side of things, and the pot, it is an empty pot. We'd like to, for the pot to be filled. So we'd like to really get more support. Our launch is going to be on the 18th of September at Bertha House. So we invite people to come and show their support and know more and actually meet instructors. So they will be stationed there. They'll get an opportunity to interact and ask questions because they come from different communities within the Cape Flats. And then everybody's obviously also invited to the walk, but it will be on our socials as well. So we can keep our social handles before we close. close home.
Perfect. Yeah. Awesome. Wow, this is exciting. I think you'd have an amazing conversation with Lucas as well, as our food systems lead. We're always keen on collaborating. say this in every podcast, but if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. Yes. So very, very keen on collaboration. Looking forward, how do you envision the growth of urban food spaces in South Africa, especially in a post-pandemic world?
Can I go first?
Yes, please.
there are several things in mind when I think about the future. Mm-hmm. But I think I want to start by the urgency. I think we spend a lot of time, and I have, you know, personally, we have both spent a lot of time in conferences talking about feminist food systems, feminist policies, whatnot. And I think that's important, and it's long-term work. Mm. I think the biggest thing that's urgent right now are the food prices.
Ooh.
A lot of responses around food, a lot of community movements around food. In many ways, we might be saying it, we might not be saying it, but food is expensive.
Yeah.
People, the power of money keeps people out of going into shops and to buy food, you know. So I think we really, as a country, as a global currency, as a sort of local, we need to really address first and foremost, why is food so expensive? Actually, not why. Let's bring down the prices. Yeah. If there's anyone listening to this and who has any kind of influence, food is too expensive. I think before we even discuss the future, the most urgent thing, so that we can have our stomachs full,
yeah,
and then our brains can think about the future.
Exactly.
And I think in the future, what I would like to see now, I got so distracted with this.
I actually want to add on to that.
Yeah.
I think here the issue might also just be, pay us enough so that we can afford to make it to the end of the month.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I really think that when it comes to inclusive pay in South Africa, people are not paid enough. You know, you get a security guard that stands and guards, you know, a specific, very big company, and he spends the rest of his day and misses time with his family, but he can't even afford to pay rent, you know, with the 3,000 rand salary that you're getting being a security guard. That's ridiculous. How do you expect someone to sustain themselves for an entire month on 3,000 rand? It takes 3,000 rands to buy groceries for one person. Now imagine, you know, someone who has a whole family. I think the broader issue really does go back to inclusive pay. Yes, make food more affordable, but pay people enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what you're bringing in is that, and this is now my answer towards the future as well, you know, we need to also recognize that when we talk about food, and I think this is also a bulk of the issue around food security in this country, and why that it's not an urgent issue is that we're so focused on different things that we separate the issues when in fact they all overlap. And I think food is such a great way to like really look at the lens of that we need to account for time, we need to account for pay, we need to account for prices, we need to account for the urban space and how it's built. And Cape Town is built in very much still in the way that apartheid was built. Like nothing
very
has changed
segregated.
About that, you know. So all these things take into account, and I think for the future, I think we need to look at that. But also, do these intersections reflect in how the governance is being run? It doesn't. Food falls through the cracks when you look at the sort of governance structures in the country.
Yeah.
You know, the city of Cape Town will tell you it's a national problem, you know. I don't know what national is doing. and then to draw it back again, I think one of the things that I will say with the utmost passion is that, you know, what I've also observed is that in the example of community kitchens, and in the example of the urgency of issues within community, I think we fail to recognize that the crisis is multiplying at such a speed, and the issues evolve. But people are constantly responding to crisis in ways that I think are sustainable, in ways that I think have potential, but they don't have the support. And what often happens is that, and now again another policy governance problem, is that there is no way right now, I think there's no direct link between government and grassroots movement, and like that where government can really put in money into grassroots movement and support it in very, very intentional ways.
Yeah.
So we're just running in very different directions. I think the future that I imagine is that the people who are living in these communities are able to have a say in where money goes.
Yes.
And, you know, and what kind of solutions come up, and they don't come from the top downwards. Mm. You know, why is there a top and a down also, you know? So where do we meet in the middle?
Yeah.
I think the future is in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. And no wonder, any input?
What do I say after such profound from me? So for me, on Saturday I was invited to a round table at an open kitchen, where we had South African and Turkish chefs just putting a spin or a twist to their dishes.
Right.
So the conversation around the table, it was also about with people that are active in the food governance systems, you know, food activists, food justice movements. And the conversation was really about, because we had to drive, it was around Franschhoek. Mm. So having to drive out of the township and out of the city and through farms with such land. And here we are as farmers, and we cry about not having access to land, and we're saying in the Western Cape, let us not say there's no land. There's lots, but the challenge here is really access to land. And you are talking about somebody that struggles to put money together, that works, but the salary is not enough to sustain them to the end of, like, we live from paycheck to paycheck. But why should it be like that? You know, we are wired in a way that I need to get out of my township to come to the city to work. You know, I'm here to make the city work. Why are there no jobs being made available closer to where I live, that I don't have to spend so much money and time away out of my family?
Yes.
So why not bring things closer to the people? Why not bring things closer to where I live? You know.
Right.
So access to jobs, you know, access to land, just access to food in terms of prices. You know, the prices that somebody dictates, you know, what I can and what I should have access or not have access to. So for me, those are the I worry about that in the future. Mm. I worry about the kind of foods that will be available in the future. We are in a hurry. We are always, we want to get somewhere at a particular time, and we want things that are produced, you know. We were making a joke about maize meal, where we are being sold, or it's advertised as it takes 2 minutes to make, you know, to make pap. Maize doesn't take, you know. So the question becomes, what kind of process did that particular maize had to go through to, you know, it's bleached. It's like, how can I be sold the idea that the white pap is the best because it's easy to cook? But, you know, if you're thinking about, because even from a mother's perspective, I come home, it's late, I would need something quick, I take a 2 minute noodle, I put it in the microwave and I feed my child. And for me, because I'm also just tired, maybe you're a mother, you think of instant porridge in the morning because you want something quick. But why should it be like that? So that for me is the future that's keeping me up at at night, having to work with children, looking at the long-term health impacts that these foods will have on these kids. We have hyperactive children, and those are contributions to what they're being fed and to what they have access to in terms of food. So for me, those are, you know, when I think about, I cringe when I think about the future. And we will have lab-produced foods, and what will they do to the kids, to the health, to the future? So
I'm really worried about the future of food, if I might put it. We're getting seedless foods and fruits in the shops because there's this urgency. Things need to be produced at a very high speed and at a very high rate.
Right. Mm. Wow. You know, and your concern is rightfully, you know, rightfully so. I think anyone who has the same worries would be able to relate to what you are saying right now. I think also maybe this is more for me or for my, because I'm only 24, and my age group, you know, I think the topic of food is not really being sold to us, or when it comes to nutritious food, we're not being taught. And maybe that's on us for not wanting to learn more. Perhaps it's an issue of it not being mainstreamed and, you know, advertised to us and you know, get drilled into us just the same way KFC, McDonald's and so on and so forth get drilled into us, you know. So I think that there's definitely still a lot of work to be done for us to have change and to really start centralizing nutrition and caring about it and its impact on our families and us individually. Thank you so much for your input, ladies. I would love to know your social handles, anyone that is keen on getting in touch with you. Is there an email address, social platforms that they can get a hold of you from?
So on Twitter and Instagram, it's at Food Agency Cape Town or at Food Agency CBT. And on Facebook, it's Food Agency Cape Town.
Okay.
And an email, email, they can email me directly or Mimi directly, but we have a general email address as Food Agency Cape Town, which is admin@foodagencycpt.com or Nomonde B.
Okay. Wonderful.
@foodagencycpt.com.
Yes. Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you so much, ladies. I have learned so much. As I said, my background in food is not great, but wow, this taught me a lot, not only from just learning about food, but from an activism point of view. The work that you are doing is incredibly important. Please, please keep up. Keep doing the great work.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's it for today's episode of Real Talk with R.E.B. A huge thank you to our guests, Sanele Siwe and Nomonde, for sharing their insights and experiences. We hope you found this conversation as inspiring and enlightening as we did. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at RAB_South Africa or email us on hello@rabvillage.com to stay updated on upcoming episodes and the latest news from RAB.